Hello, and welcome to the YGBM Science News Podcast, where we discuss the most recent science news from across the Yale community. I am Mara, a second-year PhD student from the Department of Microbiology.
And I'm Sam, first-year MPH student in the Department of Health Policy.
And before we proceed to the podcast, I just have a couple announcements for you. First of all, we will be taking a break for the next 2.5 weeks, because I'm traveling. So the next episode will be released sometime around Monday, April 29th, or possibly Tuesday, April 30th. So be on the lookout for that. Another pretty big change is the fact that we will be switching to bi-weekly schedule. After a lot of consideration, we discussed that we will prefer to make a little bit longer episodes with maybe some more highlights from different resources coming out. And for that, we'll be switching it to every other week instead of every week. So those changes are coming. And while you're waiting for us to come back with our new schedule, we're also going to be releasing a series of interviews that were recorded throughout the last month. So be on the lookout for that, and I hope you like it.
Yeah, well, while the science news is on a break, you will not be without material to listen to, which is very exciting.
Yeah. All right, let's just dive into it. What's your study about, Samantha?
So this first study was led by a Yale anthropologist, Dr. Catherine Panter-Brick, and it looked at the impact of Syrian fathers' own view of their parental involvement level versus their wives' view of their actual involvement level. And it looked at the impact of that disagreement on children's social and emotional development.
I see. So how exactly did they carry out the study?
Well, what they did is that between 2021 and 2022, the research team collected data in a prospective study of father, mother, and child triads, including 322 mothers with children between the ages of 4 and 8 whose husbands had varying degrees of involvement or reachability. Once study participants were identified, participants were interviewed in Arabic, and data on the father's involvement was collected from both the mother's perspective and the father's perspective when the father was reachable. Questions for the father from the father involvement questionnaire included statements to which respondents answered on a 4-point Likert scale, ranging from strongly disagree to strongly agree, and statements included ones such as, I am knowledgeable about my children's education, I treat my spouse well in front of our children, and I spend time with other fathers in the community. These statements varied depending on the time point during the survey period when participants were interviewed, so T1 or T2, which corresponded to either baseline or post-intervention trial periods. Other question topics that were included during the survey included family functioning, spousal relationship quality, well-being, depressive symptoms, anxiety symptoms, child mental health, and child social-emotional learning, among other things. And what the researchers did was they ran directional analyses with T1 predictors of T2 outcomes and also cross-sectional analyses with available T1 and T2 data. And in order to measure the level of spousal agreement about the father's involvement, linear regressions were used, and two covariates, those being household wealth and father education, were identified as having influence on spousal relationship quality and family function.
I see. This is actually very interesting, just from a non-scientific perspective.
Yeah.
No, human being living in all those families. Well, what exactly did they find? Tell us.
So in the end, the paper really outlined three main findings, which is that, first of all, Syrian refugee fathers reported being more involved with their family, well, their wife and child or children, than mothers reported them to be, meaning fathers were either over-reporting their involvement or mothers were under-reporting it. Second of all, father involvement components were actually isolated, were unrelated to child mental health or social emotional learning. However, what did have an impact was the levels of father-mother disagreement regarding the father-child, father-mother, or father-community involvement. So there was a negative association between that disagreement and child outcomes. So really what this means is that disagreement about these levels of involvement are what really impact children's outcomes, as this is associated, according to the paper, with worse spousal relationship quality, conflict between mothers and their children, less positive parenting, poorer child supervision, lower well-being, and more depressive symptoms. And this is all compared to children from more concordant families.
This is actually very interesting. Mostly not surprising, but very interesting. I'm curious if they reported... So you said that the degree at which fathers reported themselves being involved or not as much involved in family functions didn't have any impact on child outcomes. Did mothers reporting have any impact?
I mean, from what I read, I'm not entirely sure because I think that the real focus was looking at fathers' involvement. But that's definitely something that I can look into and report back on.
Okay. Yeah, that would be really interesting as well.
Yeah, no, and I think it's really interesting. Obviously, you can go to the link in the bio to look at the actual study. But it's also interesting to think about the study limitations just, you know, in terms of reporting bias and, you know, things that we don't know that were not included when the people were surveyed.
Yeah, of course, because this is all self-reporting. There's no objective measurements here, right?
Exactly, exactly. Yeah, so enough with my study. Mara, what is your study about?
Yeah, so the study that got my attention was performed in collaboration between Yale Cancer Center and Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston, and it focused on kidney cancer treatment. So particular focus of the study was renal cell carcinoma, which is the absolutely most prevalent type of kidney cancer one could get. I think 9 out of 10 kidney cancers are renal cell carcinoma. And what is interesting about it, too, is that while it's one of types of kidney cancer, there's also a lot of subtypes of RCC itself, and it can have impact on the optimal treatment for it. And here we're talking about both efficacy and side effects and just overall benefits of cancer treatment. Now, this is something that has been known, and there are currently several types of highly efficient treatments that are available. And for this study in particular, there are three that are most important. First of all, there are ICIs, or immune checkpoint inhibitors, which pretty much just are a type of immunotherapy. And what they do is they inhibit inhibition of immune cells so that they attack cancer cells more, right? Then the second type is anti-angiogenic tyrosine kinase inhibitors, which... So naturally, cancer tumors promote growth of blood vessels into it because they need to spread out and they need to feed themselves. And that's what's called angiogenesis. So naturally, those drugs will inhibit the angiogenic qualities of tumors. And the third one is a drug called sunitinib. And it just inhibits cellular signaling, which also inhibits the growth of tumors. Now, combination between the first two has been recently approved by the FDA and has been researched in comparison to more conservative treatment of sunitinib. And with those several types of treatment available, the challenge becomes for physicians is to choose the correct one for the patient and to see what are the benefits.
So how did they approach this problem?
Well, this is one of the studies that focuses on machine learning approaches, which I think is really exciting. So they had the data set that was based on like just different subtypes of tumors that are available from RCC patients, and they developed and they trained this machine learning algorithms to differentiate between different subtypes of RCC that's in this data set. And by what I mean by different subtypes is that they looked at transcriptomic data. So as we, I feel like already talked about this a lot, what defines a cell is not really the DNA, because DNA is mostly going to be absolutely the same between cells in one organism, but the way it's expressed. So transcriptomic data is just the expression of different parts of DNA. And this framework is going to be different from each cell. This is what differs, you know, skin cell from neuron, let's say. And that's also what differs different subtypes of cancer cells. They were looking at transcriptomic data, and then their algorithm was differentiating between different clusters of cells. So, yeah, every cell is going to be different, but you can put them together in certain groups. Now, they applied this model, and they trained it, and then they also applied this model to another trial results. So there was a trial by FDA that was actually trying to see if the sunitinib treatment is better or worse than novel treatment of combination of ICI and angiogenic tyrosine kinase inhibitors. The study itself had its own findings, but they wanted to see if their machine learning approach can predict those benefits by looking at different clusters of transcription. So, in fact, what they saw is that algorithm in the first study, it was able to predict the benefits from the first study, but then when it was applied to the second trial, it pretty much, the trial has shown that the combined therapy has better outcomes across the board for all tumor subtypes. So their algorithm was able to differentiate different subtypes, but then they all had similar benefits from combination treatment.
Okay, so what are the limitations?
Yeah, you're thinking what led to that. Well, first of all, they mentioned some limitations for detection itself because you need to detect the RNA that it still has, right? And one of the limitations was detecting small nucleolar RNAs, which main function of those is to guide modifications for other RNAs. So you can imagine it has pretty big impact on the cell in different situations. And the second limitation is just really the complexity of different molecular state of those tumor cells, meaning that we can't apply it to predict just as easily. And there's a lot of real-life implications here as well, because this example of combination therapy being better than like cell or signaling inhibitor drug in this case, this has had a big impact on clinical treatment, and it went from like epidemic knowledge to physiological applications pretty fast. So what I really noticed this paper is how important it is to do more research into it, because those are things applied to patients in real life.
Yeah, absolutely. And I can imagine, I mean, I feel like an ongoing theme across the pod and, you know, across studies is talking about personalized medicine and the promise of AI in terms of being able to apply personalized medicine well. And I mean, just from what you were saying about RCC and, you know, the different types of treatment, like how could personalized treatment and personalized medicine using AI be involved in this process with this problem?
Yeah, like I don't think that their AI is bad, because the function of their AI is to differentiate the different clusters, which I am pretty sure is doing a really good job at from what they saw in those two different trial sets. However, the prediction part of it is that what makes it harder, right? Because, and also this is the part of it that actually goes into like clinical application. So definitely more research is needed for this purpose. But this is an example of really good, solid research, which I found really cool to read.
We love solid research.
Okay, guys, I think this was all for this week. Thank you for being with us.
Yeah, this was Mara and Sam with YJBM Science News. See you next week. Bye.